This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. It's an examination of the effect of the Welcoming City Ordinance now passed for the town of Normal. Police Chief Rick Leichner says it's not a ban on communication with federal authorities.
We'll go through a process, look at it on a case-by-case basis, and when we think it's appropriate, we will assist or reach out or share information with immigration.
Chief Leichner and Mayor Chris Koos talk with GLT's Charlie Schlenker about the town's new Welcoming City Ordinance. Besides caffeine, find out what it takes to create 48 websites for 48 nonprofits in 48 hours. GLT's Ryan Denham reports on the United Way Hackathon, which helps nonprofit agencies communicate online. And it's a conversation with Black queer activist Charlene Carruthers. She'll be at a weekend summit at Illinois Wesleyan on colorblind racism. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's Tuesday, May 8th, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from country financial representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Town of Normal council members have extended the life of a TIF district and approved a welcoming city ordinance. GLT's Charlie Schlenker talks with Mayor Chris Koos about those agenda items and more.
The mayors of Bloomington and Normal stopped by GLT's Sound Ideas following their regular and special council meetings. Mayor Chris Koos, thanks for coming in today.
Always good to talk.
Let's start out with a talk about the TIF district. You extended the life. What merits extension?
What merits extension is the fact that when the recession hit in 2008, it kind of put redevelopment in Uptown Normal and in much of the United States on about a 5 to 6 year hiatus. And we have two or three key properties that are still in need of development. And extending the TIF will allow us to do that. Now, I'm hoping you're going to ask some follow-up questions on that, because extending the TIF is not the whole story.
So tell us the rest of that story then.
So what we are going to do is taking the TIF, which expires in 2016, and we are extending it for 12 years with the permission of all the taxing bodies involved.
And that's a hard lift for school districts too.
Yes, it is, and understandably. And so what happens is we have identified three parcels of ground that have not developed, and they're on the north of Uptown Circle, to the left and to the right, and an unfinished space in the College Avenue parking deck. And so in 2026, when the current TIF would expire, we will take all the dollars that the taxing bodies were supposed to get in 2016 and rebate those dollars to them. The only TIF income that we would keep to use for redevelopment would come from the three properties that we've identified. So in effect, all the taxing bodies would be made whole in 2026,
except,
as promised.
Except for that one area.
Except for that one area. And currently that one area doesn't generate any revenue because the town owns all the property. So it generates no taxes now. None.
So a larger question, though, is how do you determine when a TIF district is performing well and whether it's worth extending as a development tool?
You know, I think you have to look at that as case by case. You know, there are other areas in the TIF that have never developed, primarily south of the tracks. But it's not ready. And we're not ready to go to RFP for that property. There are other things that we have to do, such as the underpass, things like that. But these properties, the ones we've carved out, there's interest. There's current and active interest. The Trailside East project being the one on the forefront. There is active interest in that, and they're going to need, probably going to need a tax increment that is broader than 8 years.
Why do that, though, instead of just starting a new TIF for that one small area that's blighted?
It gets wonky. in terms of state statute and law. And our TIF consultants and experts say this is the best way to do it, to get it done. It's the cleanest and best way to do it. But we have to reassure the taxing bodies and let them know they will be made whole in 2026.
Now, is that an ironclad guarantee, or is that a memorandum of understanding? What force does that have?
It's going to be an ironclad guarantee. We will do that.
And how much will they be gaining then?
Oh, boy. Now you ask me a tough one I can't answer. Significantly more than they are now.
Okay. By the way, the Town of Normal Council passed a welcoming city ordinance the other night.
By the way, is an interesting way of saying that.
Irony intended there. Explain as best you can, how will an undocumented immigrant's interactions with Normal police or town staff really be different before and after?
It really won't be that much different in terms of what the actual practice has been for the Town of Normal. In terms of when our police officers are called for assistance or are on a crime scene and have witnesses, if our police or if our fire department responds with emergency medical services, immigration is not an issue to us at that point.
It seems like the Keep Families Together Coalition was willing to compromise on a few things. Where did their position soften or change, and how did that lead to passage?
I think the softening and the common understanding, I think it was a process over a couple of months and many meetings. And I think it was a development of trust between the town and specifically the police department and Keep Families Together Coalition.
Or rather the police chief in this instance, because he's the one who signs off on whether communication gets to go forward to immigration officials or not.
That's true. But Chief Bleichner vetted this through his command staff. He vetted it through his rank-and-file officers. Everyone had an opportunity to respond. And everyone, it appears, was comfortable with the procedure.
Police chiefs change. Is the Keep Families Together Coalition going to be equally comfortable if a different, more restrictive police chief were to come in?
I think because council has taken it as a policy issue that a future police chief with a more stern opinion would have to get approval from council to rescind that ordinance.
Well, that raises the question, if it's all administrative, why did the council have to act at all? What was the importance of that?
As the chief says, it memorializes a process. It publicly states to people that we are serious about that policy in the community. I quoted last night, and I'll give it to you again. Sam Goldwyn, the famous movie producer, said a verbal agreement isn't worth the paper it's printed on. So to have this codified, I think, gives people some reassurance that we are indeed serious about this.
Bloomington's council has struggled to even bring this to a vote, much less a passing vote. Why did your approach yield benefits or resolution, rather, faster?
You know, I can't answer that. I can tell you in terms of the Town of Normal, it was through collaborative meetings. There was give and take. There were things that the coalition wanted that we didn't want to do. There were things that we wanted that the coalition wasn't willing to do. So both sides had to compromise and come to an agreement that both parties could live with.
Bloomington's, do you think it's important for Bloomington to pass something similar so there's consistency across city boundaries?
You know, I hesitate to editorialize on what another city should or shouldn't do. Hopefully, we've established a path that somebody could take to get to a resolution on an issue like that, whether or not they can do it or any other city can do it. You know, that's something that they have to sit at the table and try to accomplish if they wish.
The Keep Families Together Coalition went pretty hard at Bloomington in terms of demonstrations and rallies and public comment periods. Why was the approach different to you?
Well, actually, early on, they came pretty hard at us too. They came in some meetings and offered what they called non-negotiables, and they were non-negotiable for us. But it started a dialogue.
Mayor Chris Koos of the town of Normal, thanks for coming in today.
Good to be here.
I'm Charlie Schlenker.
And I'm Mike McCurdy. The mayors of Bloomington and Normal join us on most Tuesdays following Monday evening council meetings. Next week, you'll hear from City of Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner. That's next Tuesday on GLT's Sound Ideas. Normal Police Chief Rick Bleichner says he's been getting significant feedback already from the town council's action to approve a welcoming city ordinance. Bleichner says he's pleased with the tone of that feedback so far. And Charlie Schlenker also has that interview.
I think the vast majority of it has been positive. Individuals who I think understand that, coming together, having a conversation, police, town, community, was beneficial. I mean, we were able to get to a point where I think both sides felt good about the outcome of it and what was in the ordinance. I think a few individuals who I've heard some negative feedback from are, I think, just philosophically opposed to illegal immigration and what that stands for. And then there's also some that just a few of them that clearly had not taken the time to read the ordinance because they were commenting on things that simply were not in there.
So what have they missed about it?
Well, I think at this point there are individuals who believe that it's going to be jeopardize public safety. And as I told council last night, I certainly would not support something if I felt that there was genuinely a risk or that in some way, shape, or form it negatively impacted public safety. Others who say that this is not going to allow us to communicate with federal officials. And I said, look, that was one of the things that I felt most strongly about was that in general— not just the police department, but the town's philosophy is to collaborate and cooperate with other state and local and federal partners because we find we get a lot more done that way. And we dispel a lot of misinformation, and this is no different. And so in this particular case, we aren't saying that we're not going to cooperate or communicate or assist or share information. What we're saying is that we understand the sensitivity of those the immigration issue in this country, and that when we do think it's necessary, we'll go through a process to vet that information, look at it on a case-by-case basis, and when we think it's appropriate, we will assist or reach out or share information with immigration.
Why do you think that approach was palatable to the Keep Families Together Coalition mm-hmm. in Normal, and in Bloomington, they're going for a more strict ban on certain kinds of communication?
Yeah. I mean, certainly that's a question they would be best to answer. I mean, from my standpoint, what I've heard was that we've continued to build a relationship from the visioning process through the police and culture and race relations conversations that we've had. And I think there's just been a relationship built there, if you will, with members of that coalition. Who also represent other groups that we've come to the table and had conversations with. And I think in a sense, too, our elected officials and myself and staff had said, when asked, here's what our contacts have been on immigration matters and how we go about them. And when the group fact-checked that against our organization, they found that we were doing what we were saying we were doing. So whenever you have a situation where your actions back up your words, I think that goes a long way towards building a positive relationship.
And how would you characterize the level and frequency of communication with federal immigration authorities?
It is very sparse. I mean, for us, over the course of a three-year period, we had a handful of times in which we had conversations or communication with them. And all of those revolved around active, ongoing criminal investigations or an investigation in which was deemed, very reasonable that contact was necessary.
Part of the issue is perception. How will you as a department continue to work on the perception that immigrants have that they are fearful of mm-hmm. police?
Well, the first point is, I think, and I said it last night at the council meeting, I think a lot of why we were able to reach agreement is not my work. It's the work of all of my staff, the ones who are out there every day engaging and interacting with the community and conducting themselves in a certain way. And so I think that builds trust. The community understands that. They see that. They're engaging with officers. And I think that was the, you know, the first step in doing that. And what we did was we have developed a policy that really pulled from some existing policies. It pulled from the Trust Act, and it pulled from the new, what was proposed ordinance at the time, but the adopted ordinance last night, and solidified it in one policy that gives staff and supervisors direction on, you know, what the expectations are. And I think that's really all that can be expected. They want to know what the guidelines are and what the expectations are moving forward. And that's just responsible management. And also, I'm sorry, the other part of that too is that that didn't get a lot of conversation last night is something that we've been doing, which is the U visa process, which is when individuals who are immigrants in this country that aren't here legally, who have been victims of certain crimes, can apply for a U visa status, which means that if they were involved in a crime, they were a victim of a crime, and they were assisting law enforcement in the investigation or prosecution of a particular case, they can make application for a U visa, which gives them some temporary status here in this country. But part of that is a law enforcement certification letter in which a organization reviews the application and then basically says, yes, in their opinion, that this individual is cooperating with law enforcement, they're active, they're assisting in the investigation, and that we believe that one of these crimes, the criteria are met. That is not an approval. That is just a step in the application process. It then goes to officials who are much more well-versed in the immigration process to analyze that and review that. So that is one step. And so that part of it, we've been doing that, but we have not really publicized that. We've not had a formal process on that. And part of that, I think, goes hand in hand with the ordinance.
How often has that been put in the hopper?
That's one of those. It has become more and more frequent, probably over the last 5 or 6 years, but I would say we probably get anywhere from 5 to 8 a year. It's not a large volume of those that come into us.
How do you think that affects public perception to have that tool in use?
Well,
even on the episodic level that you just described.
Well, I mean, when it was passed back in 2000, it was by, I think it was a unanimous vote of Congress, because at the time it was, they saw the benefit of safety and security in this country, that if you've got individuals who are here who have been a victim of crime, who want to cooperate and bring the offenders of those crimes to hold them accountable, then there is a benefit to that rather than having that person then be subject to deportation because they're reporting a crime or be in fear of that. There is a benefit to the justice system to having those individuals here. Also, it helps prevent, I think, future crimes from occurring. It prevents them from being victimized and others from being victimized. And if they're comfortable in doing that, then they're going to feel more comfortable in coming forward to report crimes or when they see certain things. And to me, that really speaks to overall community safety.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker with Normal Police Chief Rick Bleichner talking about the welcoming community ordinance passed by the town council. Bloomington Alderman Karen Schmidt and retired ISU professor Bob Bradley have talked a little bit about a welcoming community initiative as something that Bloomington and Normal could do, which requires sustained and in-depth communication between police and the town at large and the immigrant communities. Are you receptive to that sort of more in-depth approach, using officer time for that? And how could that look?
I mean, certainly that's something, you know, my job is to provide information to the policymakers to make those decisions. From my standpoint, I mean, the visioning process and the comprehensive plan process was very engaging. And matter of fact, we've taken portions of that and we're still continuing to have those discussions with the you know, potential of this police and community relations conversation that's continued to go on. You know, I just see that as another step. And in my opinion, as I've said before, community policing is not just an idea. It is not just one program. It's more of a philosophy, and a lot of that is you know, rooted in what we did with the welcoming community and tying that ordinance back to the comprehensive plan was really sitting down and just having that conversation. And it's not always about sitting down and having discussions with people that think like you do or agree with you. Community policing is bringing everybody, supporters and advocates and individuals and organizations and people really who have had different experiences with police than what we think and who have different views of policing really to get everybody's opinion. It doesn't mean that we're going to come up with one common solution, but I think you got to understand all sides to come up with the best plan.
Mayor Chris Koos has given you a lot of credit for the relatively low emotional freight and the civilized part of the discourse that has happened in the town of Normal. How do you think that your approach has differed from what's happened in Bloomington?
Well, like I said earlier, you know, I don't know that it's my praise. I think it speaks volumes for what our officers and our staff do every day. It's the engagement they have with the community. It's how they approach policing. It's how they embody the philosophy of community policing. You know, really the credit, you know, I appreciate those comments, but the credit really goes to them. They're the ones who, again, they walk the walk and back up what we're saying we're doing.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Rick Bleichner is the police chief of the town of Normal. The annual crime stats are out, and they show about a 4% overall drop in total number of crimes reported last year. The lowest level in at least 14 years, is it?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. What are major trends that you'd like to focus in on?
Well, I mean, for us, overall, yeah, we're just over 4% decrease in what we would consider our index crimes. That's the murder, the sex assault, the robbery, the ag assault, the burglaries, those that fit into those categories. Overall, I would say, compared to total crimes, there are other ones that don't factor into those that are also crimes reported to us that don't fall in that Part 1 category, that fall into the Part 2 categories. And overall, we're down about 3%. So, again, the message is good, you know, that reported crime is down. Also, looking across the categories from the UCR report that you mentioned, you know, sexual assault-related crimes are up a little bit. I think they're up about 13%. That is one of those where I would say that I don't know that, again, there is a spike. But what I think we've had is we've got better education, better awareness, and we've got better reporting. I still think it is a small percentage of the amount of those crimes that are occurring out there. The others really are either flat as far as no increase, no decrease, a couple of them, or we've had some pretty significant decreases. And I would say in our robbery category, we're down about 36%, and looking at our aggravated battery and assaults, they're down almost 20%. And our burglary category, which I would say is one of the big ones, is down almost 30%.
None of those are directly susceptible to enforcement, except mm-hmm. in cases where there's a ring, say a burglar's, that mm-hmm. that you knock on the head and mm-hmm. take off the streets. Mm-hmm. That those just tend to happen. Why are they down, do you think?
I would think, you know, when you talk about that, I would say that there's probably some education and awareness in that, too, that goes to it. I know in some of the categories, you know, like the aggravated batteries, even the burglaries and things, those are probably public awareness. Those are situations in which we've had some focuses on. We knew that there were certain issues, whether it be vehicle burglaries, residential burglaries, student break-ins, and we focused in those particular areas. We used our crime data. We shared that with residents. And, you know, we found out, for example, in the vehicle burglary stuff, the vast majority of those were vehicles that were left unlocked. So we put a campaign together to try and get people to lock their doors. You know, I think it was 96% of all the vehicle burglaries that happened were unlocked vehicles. So chances are if you lock your vehicle, you've just increased or decreased your odds of becoming a victim.
Congratulations, your education program worked. However, students graduate. You have to do it all over again.
Correct.
How much time did it take to do that education effort?
I think it's been going on for the 27 years that I've been here. I think we have tried to do some additional outreach, and you mentioned, you know, with the students graduating and a new group coming in. I think, you know, student services has been in the Dean of Students Office has been very helpful in sharing that information for us, especially around those times of, break and Thanksgiving, Christmas, spring break. And a lot of the messaging that we tried to push out was, you know, if you like it, lock it up, because, you know, if somebody's going to break into your apartment, they may take the 50-inch flat screen TV that's on your wall that belongs to your landlord, but they're not going to take your $1,200 MacBook if you've got it and you take it with you or you lock it up somewhere. And so what we found was not only burglaries decreased, but also the value or the amount of items that were taken decreased significantly.
How much?
I would say thousands of dollars. I don't have an exact figure on that, but it certainly has decreased. And I would say a lot of that, again, is just education and awareness that the Dean of Students Office has helped. Our community outreach has helped. It's a lot of different things.
You mentioned the increase in sexual assault reports, about 13%. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, Bloomington went up on the order of 60-70%. Mm-hmm. And yet Normal's the place where there are a lot of students, a lot of alcohol, a lot of sexual assaults are tied to alcohol. Mm-hmm. You would expect, just on the surface of it, for the increase ratios to be flipped between the two cities. Is there any accounting for that?
No, I don't have one. Again, that's probably something that Chief Hefner or whoever his replacement might be able to comment on a little bit more. But yeah, from our standpoint, I mean, we certainly try and work closely with the university. We work closely with Stepping Stones and other groups to you know, share awareness. For Sex Assault Awareness Month, we also rolled out our campaigns that dealt with, social media campaigns on not, blaming victim, to end victim blaming, and then also to be the change with our poster campaigns that talked about, because we think there's some opportunity there to be preventative in some of these cases, you know, in the situations where a lot of our sex assaults, they're what I would consider either an acquaintance or somebody who's known through a friend. They're not somebody who's knocking somebody over the head while they're walking to their car or jumping out of the bushes and grabbing somebody. So that's something that is a bit of a bright spot. So that means that we think we've got an opportunity to speak to the community in general, whether it be the student body, whether it be the community. If you're in a situation where you happen to see something that doesn't look right, somebody who's maybe overly intoxicated, someone who's, you know, got three or four people around them, it seems to be an uncomfortable situation, somebody who's looking for a way home, you know, step up and be that change, be that individual or that group of individuals that says, you know what, this is a situation that doesn't seem right to me. I'm going to do what I can to see if I can't remove that person from that and find a way to either get them back with their friends or to get them home or back with somebody who's safe and who they trust rather than leave them in that situation. And we think there's an opportunity to make some change there.
Is there a difference in how Normal police and ISU police are interfacing with the student justice system in this now Me Too, not anymore generation?
That's a good question. I mean, I think when we look at it, we take all of the allegations and the reports seriously, but we also understand and we aren't, you know, we don't candy coat it for individuals, that we also have to lay out a series of evidence that proves up the case. And so that may mean asking difficult questions, and it doesn't mean that we don't believe the individual that's reporting it. It simply means that in order to move to that prosecution phase, there are some things that are going to be either witness statements or physical evidence and things like that that we're going to need to build a case to prosecute. Some individuals are comfortable with that. Other individuals aren't. So we certainly try and respect the victim's rights in those cases. We try and work with them. And we've found that over time, I mean, I think it speaks volumes that when we had during the Sex Assault Awareness Month and our campaign to end victim blaming, we had three individuals who were survivors of sexual assault that felt comfortable telling their story, as comfortable as you can, because of the way they felt that our detectives, our officers, state's attorney's office, their advocates handled their particular situation. So that to me, I think, although, you know, and some, again, had positive outcomes, some had outcomes they wish would have been different, but I think overall their general feeling was that they were treated with dignity and respect and fairness in the process.
Drug crimes went down 29%.
Mm-hmm.
What happened there?
Well, I think we're seeing that ebb and flow of the civil process, that under 10 grams of marijuana becoming a civil violation, in which we typically would, before, would have been a criminal arrest in most cases, not all. But I think what we've seen there is that's the bulk of the decrease there is when you have that that's no longer going to be a criminal violation. The drug crimes that seems to be the bulk of where our decrease is.
Town of Normal Police Chief Rick Bleichner spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. Traffic accidents rose for the third year in a row. Bleichner says a lot of that is because of distracted driving. Four key intersections in town produce a significant share of the accidents, but Bleichner says the number two location of crashes is parking lots. You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. You have choices, coffee or tea, right or left, dog or cat. You also have choices when it comes to transportation, pay rising gas prices or not. You don't have to reach for the car keys for every trip. The Good to Go Commuter Challenge challenges you to think differently about your transportation. Registration is open for the challenge May 14th through the 20th. Daily drawings for a $25 Visa gift card to anyone logging a sustainable commute. Are you good to go? Learn more and register at goodtogomclain.org.
Support for GLT comes from State Farm Bank, offering vehicle loan calculators, consultation, and rates for new and used cars, trucks, or SUVs. Additional information available through the Vehicle Loan Resource Center at statefarm.com. State Farm Bank, member FDIC. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. True leadership is uncomfortable. According to author and activist Charlene Carruthers, that's because the change agent changes their own world. Carruthers spoke last month to the Multicultural Leadership Program and will be at a summit this weekend at IWU on colorblind racism. Carruthers tells GLT's Judy Valente she wants to challenge the program graduates with questions that might make them uncomfortable too.
Answering the question of what are we trying to build, and also are we ready to actually win the type of world that we're fighting for? Because in order to win the type of world that we're fighting for, we actually have to give some things up. We have to change the things that make us feel most comfortable. We have to get used to things happening in a way that they don't normally happen. Like, for instance, one thing that most people do whenever they have a problem, when they are in conflict, when they experience harm or violence, is they call the police. Because that is one of the places or the institutions that people feel is set up to keep us safe. However, what I believe is that we need to imagine a world where we keep each other safe, where we build communities that are based in thriving and not based in fear.
You're talking about very big things there, very big changes that have to happen. What about small, simple changes that people can do in their lives to build community and feel safer in the communities they live in?
Well, I believe that's what people are already doing by being a part of this type of program. They're making small changes. And we can all make individual changes as individual people. The change that I'm interested in making, the change that I know people across the world are interested in making, is actually changing systems. And that requires commitment and the buy-in from everyday people. It means that we invest our local dollars. We advocate for our local governments to invest money in systems that are like community response teams, right? So what would it mean to actually say, we want to build a community response team to conflict, violence, and harm in our neighborhood, where we train people in our communities? It's things like that. What's uncomfortable oftentimes is for us to talk about the bigger things because for some folks, they seem unreasonable. But it's important to note that we haven't always lived in this type of world. We haven't always lived in neighborhoods that were surveilled. Not everybody in this country has. Black people have always lived under surveillance in this country. But for us to think about that, what would it mean for us to talk to each other? If we want to talk about small things, for us to talk through our own conflict with each other instead of looking at someone else to do it.
What about changes that we have to do within ourselves? I mean, I've always been told, change yourself and then try to change the world.
Well, you know, the people who are in power are never asked that question. People who are billionaires and millionaires are never asked, how are they changing themselves? Because they're too busy changing the world. And people who live in this world, who have power held over them, are always asked to improve as individuals, always asked how they can be better. We need to start asking different questions. Like, it's not a matter of being good people. There are good people who do horrible things, who vote yes on laws that criminalize people, people who vote yes on laws that take food stamps out of people's homes, people who vote yes on laws that take health care away, and they're nice people. They're nice people. They treat people in their lives well, but they make decisions that impact the lives of thousands of millions of people. So it's not about a matter of changing just yourself internally when we're talking about people who are bearing the brunt of systemic oppression. I want to have a conversation about how we're changing systems.
So how do you change a system? I mean, what is step one, step two? Because even in your own writings, you say so many people, particularly our African-American citizens, our Latino citizens, our poor white citizens, are so busy just trying to survive. They don't have the time or the energy or the resources to work on this systemic change.
Well, step one is actually organizing, and people do that every single day. There's not been a movement in this country that's been successful in overturning social or any type of oppression that didn't involve people who were directly impacted by it. Whether we're looking at the Montgomery bus boycott, or we look at the Poor People's Campaign, or we're looking at the various prisoner rights campaigns that have happened with inside of prisons, it's people who are directly impacted by these. When we talk about voting rights, these weren't wealthy people who were doing these mass actions across the country during the civil rights movement. And so it's about making a choice to be involved in whatever way you can be involved. Not everybody can become a full-time organizer or do this work all the time, but most people can show up to a meeting, right? Most people can engage in political conversation. People can develop their own understanding of what's going on in the world. Those are the things that make up organizing. Organizing is about working with people who have shared interests and shared values and are developing a shared plan or a shared strategy and taking action collectively in order to create the kind of change they want to see in the world.
So it seems as though you're saying banding together with others is very important, finding a group of people that will support your objectives with you.
Absolutely. I mean, you can do many things as an individual, but you can't go as far and as wide unless you are working in a collective space with other people. Because the kind of change that I'm interested in is not about just improving a block. I'm talking about a whole neighborhood, a whole community, a whole country, a whole world. And that will not happen as the result of a small group of people in a room together. It'll happen with multiple groups of people in multiple rooms, spaces across many places, working towards various different things, right? In order to get us where we want to go.
You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Judy Valente. I'm talking with Charlene Carruthers, who is an author and an activist, and will be giving the graduation talk at this year's Multicultural Leadership Program graduation. You've written quite a bit about the African-American community, and you say that their stories are incomplete. Their stories are not often included in the societal discourse or the political discourse. Explain what you meant by that.
What I mean by that is that when we tell incomplete stories about the conditions of people, particularly Black people and all oppressed people, then we're going to have an incomplete solution. So if we tell a narrow story about what's happening as it relates to racial justice, right, one that only talks about a particular type of person, then we miss so many other groups, so many other people. And that whatever solution we come up with, unless we're actually working at the margins, like if we're working at the margins, then we're going to miss everybody else. But if we only work with what's comfortable, then the solutions we come up with won't actually address the majority of people who are impacted by any given system of oppression, be it racism, white supremacy, capitalism, or patriarchy.
Well, how do you get those stories out in a more complete fashion then?
It takes a lot of work. And oftentimes, and I think it's really important for listeners where you are, is that it requires some people to get out of the way. And
meaning people in the white power structure? Is that what you mean?
No, that's not the words that I would use, white power structure. What I mean are people who control, who have influence and power over media, who have influence and power over education. Those people may or may not be white. So I'm going to be real clear about that. There are people who work in concert every single day with perpetuating systems of oppression who are not white, right? And so what I'm talking about is, yes, white supremacy, also capitalism and patriarchy. All those things are connected. You can't just talk about one thing without talking about the other. And so we're not talking about, like, small potatoes here. When we're talking about people's lives, we're talking about millions upon millions of people's lives. And so we have to think both with our own local conditions and also connect it to broader things that are happening in the world.
You have an organization called BYP 100, Black Youth Project 100.
Yes.
So much has been written and discussed about Black youth, and particularly young Black men, the unemployment, the sense of hopelessness that so many have. What does your program try to do? How does your program try to address that?
So BYP 100 is a national organization of young Black activists between the ages of 18 and 35. And what we do is focus on transformative leadership development, direct action organizing, public policy work, and also engaging in electoral politics for the sake of building political power. And to your previous question, it is an incomplete story for us to understand the conditions of Black people and only talk about Black men and boys. We have to talk about Black men and boys, absolutely, and we should. And it's an incomplete story when we do not talk about Black women and girls in the narrative of what's happening to Black people and how Black people are impacted. Because if we tell just a single story or a narrow story of what's happening to Black people, then we miss how the systems that impact our people also impact broad, big parts of our community. And so the same solutions that are going to work for one set may not work for the other. They actually may harm the other group. And so we have to take all those things into account. And that's what we do in BYP 100. We're not an organization that only talks about one group of Black people. It's about the liberation of all Black folks. And in the, you know, the tradition of Fannie Lou Hamer, nobody's free until everybody's free. And so we actually have to be concerned with all kinds of Black people, Black queer folks, Black transgender folks, Black people who are disabled. And there's enough room for many people to do that work, because everybody can't do all of the work. Everybody's not best positioned to do all of the work. So we need a lot of people. We need a lot of hands on deck in order to get the work done.
The Multicultural Leadership Program has a very diverse group of people. There, you'll find Indian Americans there. You'll find Latino and Latina Americans there. How does their stories fit into all of this? Are their stories also incomplete? And what do you have to say to people who are not Black, but are somehow living on the margins?
So I enter the conversation as a Black woman, and I speak from my experiences and the history of the people that I'm a part of, right? What's also important and what has always been done is that Black folks have never only, in my work, doesn't only focus on Black people. What's clear to me is that if we actually, in order for Black people to be free, as the Combahee River Collective said in the 1970s, in order for Black people, for Black women in particular, to be free, it will require the dismantling of so many systems of oppression that everybody else will be free as a result. So the liberation of Black folks absolutely impacts the liberation of all oppressed peoples. And so that requires us to work with each other, right? And for people to understand that our liberation is intrinsically connected.
Charlene Carruthers is an activist and an author. She will be the keynote speaker at the Multicultural Leadership Program graduation this year in Bloomington Normal. Thank you so much for talking about this.
Thank you.
I'm Judy Valente.
Charlene Carruthers is the author of the book Unapologetic and a community organizer on the South Side of Chicago. She'll be at an Illinois Wesleyan University summit on the new frontiers of colorblind racism May 12th through the 14th. She spoke to GLT's Judy Valente via Skype for Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from CEFQ, offering competitive rates for home equity lines of credit. Borrowers get personalized service without the hidden fees or early payoff penalties. Plus, CEFQ even covers closing costs for qualified members. Information at CEFQ.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Last weekend, many of us were out and about enjoying the first really nice stretch of warm weather. But for hundreds of civic-minded technology volunteers, they spent two straight days indoors, huddled in cubicles, feeding off coffee and teamwork. As GLT's Ryan Denham reports, their work may reshape the local nonprofit community for years into the future.
In a second-floor office space attached to a giant auto manufacturing plant, an army of technology volunteers was on hour 18 of their hackathon. It was about noon Saturday, day two of the 48-hour hackathon at Rivian Automotive. Some had stayed until 3 in the morning the night before, getting ready for today's visit with their clients. Their clients were local nonprofits, 48 of them to be exact.
Now, maybe asking for too much.
We can add it to your wish list.
Thank you. To create just a fade in and fade out of multiple pictures on the landing?
Yeah. Can you do that? Yep, that's what we did.
Over 225 volunteers from State Farm and all around Bloomington Normal teamed up last weekend for 48 and 48, building 48 websites for 48 local nonprofits in 48 hours. 48 and 48 started in Atlanta, and it's been done in bigger cities like Boston and Raleigh-Durham.
I'm totally geeking out just being here. It's really cool.
That's Tejas Johnny, a board member with the Community Healthcare Clinic, which was getting a new website. He had just met with his project development team, and he left with a big smile on his face.
We need to be able to tell our story right to our donors, to our patients, to our anyone and everyone out there in a community who's wanting to invest in this, website is a great way to do it. And so I'm really excited about it.
So how badly did the Community Healthcare Clinic need a new website? Let's put it this way. When the clinic moved to a new location in Normal about 18 months ago, they literally couldn't update their address on their website. It won't be wrong anymore. Instead of web development, the clinic can spend its money instead on medication and services for its patients. That's according to Executive Director Angie McLaughlin. She says the new site will improve the clinic's ability to raise money and recruit volunteers.
And then just to have a really cool project like this, where you have hundreds of volunteers coming in on the weekend. I mean, the clinic and the free clinic sector, we value volunteerism, and we encourage it ourselves and have hundreds of volunteers. So just for that to come together, it's really cool to see.
Those volunteers worked around the clock from Friday night till Sunday afternoon. They split into around 22 development teams, each tasked with building websites for local nonprofits, like the clinic or an animal rescue, a library, or the Boys and Girls Club. Each site is valued at more than $30,000. The gargantuan effort made for quite a site at Rivian, which occupies the old Mitsubishi plant in West Normal. Meals were set up inside the manufacturing plant itself, and developers huddled together in cubicles at the expansive second-floor offices, bouncing ideas off their nonprofit clients.
And we want to show that barometer to say, you're not all the way there yet, could you give us some money sort of thing? Does that make sense?
Yes, it's perfect. I like it.
Leah Garcia is a digital business analyst at State Farm. She was one of five volunteers on the team that worked on the clinic's website, plus another one for a human services agency in DeWitt County.
I felt like this was going to be a good opportunity to use some of my skill sets that I had and be able to apply them and help out the nonprofits in the community and then also get a better engagement and sense of what's going on in our community.
Garcia's team actually started work on the clinic's website before Friday. They did their homework and learned about the clinic's mission and needs. They attended a clinic luncheon last week and watched YouTube videos about it. Tejas Johnny from the clinic's board says that research phase was helpful to the clinic's leaders, too.
In the process, we learned a lot of things about ourselves, and I think that was a phenomenal thing that we kind of went through. So I'm really excited about the website and what it's going to do.
Garcia also served as one of the organizers of the local 48 and 48. on its social media team.
You can see the excitement that people are getting from building these sites, which is really awesome, and then everyone kind of feeds off of that energy too, so it's been very cool.
Widely credited with bringing 48 and 48 to Bloomington Normal is Emily Schneider. She works as a business analyst for enterprise technology at State Farm. She's also a program manager coach for 48 and 48. She got involved with the Atlanta-based organization through a friend and has pitched in at several other hackathons in other bigger cities. She was excited to bring it to her hometown.
It's really providing a huge service that you might not ever see. You know, you really, a lot of these things do come to bigger cities. So having it in a smaller town, I think, it's very impactful.
The 48 nonprofits get a new WordPress-based website and the training needed to keep it updated. They were also taught the basics on digital marketing strategy. David Taylor from United Way of McLean County says that's a big help as nonprofits, including United Way, grapple with declining fundraising. He says it also fulfills a strategic priority for United Way to help convene and coordinate resources in the community, not just raise money.
This was an opportunity to bring together really expert people in a particular field to address a glaring need for a lot of nonprofits in a way that creates immense value for a small investment.
The United Way and State Farm were the lead sponsors of the event. I'm Ryan Denham.
A panel of expert judges also awarded prizes to the top development teams. You can see the winners at On 48 and 48's Twitter account. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Charlie Schlinker, Judy Valente, and Ryan Denham. Also thanks to Town of Normal Mayor Chris Koos and Town Police Chief Rick Bleichner for their time today. Find the full show podcast at WGLT.org or Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. Of course, we want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet your comments. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News. I'm at Mike McCurdy. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.